Hello and welcome to the Recon Ride. I'm Dane Cash.
And I'm Cosmo Catalano.
And we're back for Vuelta a España show number two. We are here recording the evening before the first rest day. We've already had 10 whole stages of action. So we're going to record this show to just sort of talk about all the crazy stuff that happened so far and to get into what will probably be a crazy next six stages. It's been quite a race so far, although it's still a wide open race. I mean, I feel like anybody could still run away with it. Anybody except maybe the many riders who have already crashed out or been kicked out of the race.
The Vuelta is really a race that kind of prides itself on being a little more wild and a little more open, and it's definitely delivered on that so far. I think Patrick Redford, who writes for some mainstream-ish publications about cycling from time to time, described it as a mushroom-fueled odyssey, which it kind of has been this year. I mean, there's so many different weird storylines. Should we start with Nibali? I mean, does that make a good spot for you?
Or? Yeah, that's a good place to start our mushroom-filled odyssey. Luca Paolini's mushroom-filled odyssey coming to a movie theater near you.
I wonder what the glow time on a mushroom. Anyway, a lot of talk about Vincenzo Nibali getting thrown out of the race for doing what everybody does. I guess that's the line people are using by taking a sticky bottle from a car. And it's one of those things where the people who are saying it either didn't see it or don't really understand the idea of a sticky bottle. Like, normally, you know, it's like you're coming into the bottom of a climb and there's a guy who's hanging on for dear life. And if you can just get him to a wheel to follow, 100 yards ahead, he's going to make it over the climb. And if he doesn't, he's going to have to drop out of the race. That's where you can get away with the sticky bottle. What happened with Nibali? Literally, he is at the front of a group of about 30 riders, so he's not alone. He's not in any danger of doing anything but losing some time. And the team car pulls up to him. Literally, you see him touch probably, I don't even know if he had a bottle. I think he just grabbed the car. And like immediately they hit the gas and he just gets like teleported away from the group. There is nothing I can even compare it to. It was so blatant and so terrible. I'm a fan of the idea that there should be some flexibility in the rules regarding things like drafting cars and getting a sticky bottle, but I think it's totally possible to kind of codify that flexibility to say, an isolated rider can hold onto a bottle for 10 seconds or something. Something where there's an objective line that can be crossed. And there isn't that currently in cycling. And I think you saw Astana really trying to, really just abusing that right here. There's just no excuse. And yeah, you could argue that the damage he did with this toe would have been made up for with like a 10-minute GC penalty. But the idea of punishment is not to negate the crime. It's to punish the person for breaking the rules. And to me, this was about as bad as you could do outside of, having a bag of blood hanging out of the car and getting re-injected.
Yeah, I agree that there's definitely needs to be room for some leniency because there's really no way to come down on somebody holding onto a bottle for two or three extra seconds. So it's the sort of thing that I think there needs to be some subjectivity, some openness, just because it would be kind of silly to kick someone out of a race for a botched handoff that took a couple seconds too long. And I think that's why there is that bit of subjectivity. But as you said, what we saw with Nibali, there is really no objective line, but it crossed it anyway. I mean, it crossed any sort of line that would exist and that should exist. He went far faster than would have been humanly possible in that situation, thanks to the car. Usually you see cars just kind of continuing at the same speed that a rider is going. In this instance, he went almost double the speed that he would have been going, thanks to purely the car. So I agree that it was just well beyond the pale. And yeah, it was a harsh penalty. But as you say, you need that kind of penalty to show people, hey, you can't do that. That's just not okay.
And while we're on cars, I we Peter Sagan, as he tends to do, had a pretty high profile incident, clearly got launched out of the bunch by a collision with a motorcycle, got up, like punched the team doctor's car, kicked the motorcycle, starts yelling at the motorcycle. And he abandoned the next day because he was pretty messed up in this crash. There's a great still frame of him kind of upside down with his ass in the air. Can I say ass?
I think you can say ass. We're not subject to FCC regulations on a podcast.
All right, I'm gonna run with it. I'm gonna say ass as much as I can in this episode.
Please do, yeah.
So it looks like a cartoon, except it's obviously not. And I can absolutely see being angry about this. And I think there's more to it than just anger and pain at being crashed out of a race. Like, I don't believe there's currently a system for kind of punishing or otherwise kind of controlling how people drive in a race. And we've seen it. We saw it with Johnny Hoogerland. We saw it with Jesse Sargent this spring, I think, at Tour of Flanders. You know, that as much as crashing is an inevitable part of cycling, you know, in the peloton, people know who's dangerous, they know who isn't, and there's sort of a weird Lord of the Flies system for doling out justice, I guess. But for the cars and drivers, I feel like it would be a lot easier to kind of keep a point system, keep a tally, like with a regular driver's license, and say, hey, you know, you're really screwing up when you're driving in the race. You're dangerous, and we're sorry, but you're fired. You can't do this anymore. And I mean, that again seems like something the UCI can maybe codify.
Yeah, I'm in total agreement on that. I feel like the UCI kind of dropped the ball, not immediately coming in after San Sebastian and coming up with some sort of solution to this problem. And the fact that it happens again a couple of weeks later really kind of emphasizes that point that they need to act. One problem that I kind of see is that there's whatever they do with the drivers, however they come up with a way to regulate the drivers, there's still really no way to rectify the situation for Sagan, for Van Avermaet. You can punish the drivers, you can disincentivize running into riders, but there's really no recompense for a rider who lost out on a San Sebastian win, who lost out on a Vuelta stage win. And I can't really think of a solution either. Maybe pacing them back up to the peloton. I don't really know what the solution is. But in any case, even if you reduce the amount of times that this happens, it's still going to suck for the person who gets hit. And that's kind of, to me, the worst part of this is that there's nothing for Sagan to do. There's nothing that can be done, I guess, for Sagan to get back on and contest the stage. He's battered and bruised after going down, and he's immediately well outside of any chance of getting back onto the peloton. So no matter what, it's just a huge bummer for Sagan.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things, I mean, as Bob Roll would say, that's bike racing for you. You know, there are so many things that happen in a bike race, again, kind of going back to Nibali on this, that just can't be made up for. You know, you can say, oh, well, you know, he only gained X amount of time, but at the same time, there's no, what about the rest of those guys in that group? You know, why didn't they get to go up with him? So there's, at some point, you know, there is just, there are unfixable wrongs that kind of happen. And in some ways, that's really unfair. And in other ways, it makes the sport a really excellent parallel for life.
I think that's a really good way to characterize it. And, I think that also just shows what a sad, sad existence TJ Van Garderen's been having lately. He's in a pretty bad way after his Vuelta crash. Nasser Buhani, Chris Boekmans, Dan Martin. I mean, there's just been... It was a pretty bad day the other day when all those guys went down, and it was just one of many crashes that has seriously affected the Vuelta peloton. Although there haven't been any of the Quintana, the Froome, and Aru level guys, but...
I believe I picked TJ Van Garderen as a top GC favorite.
You did pick TJ to win the entire race. Perhaps you actually were the reason that he crashed out. I mean, I'm not going to rule out you putting the hex on him with that.
No, it's not. You know, I would, if I believed in the hex, I would feel bad about that. But I feel a little bit less bad because TJ immediately after the crash was really like, hey, we need to get rid of radios. They're unsafe. Without bringing up any data, like, I'm totally behind making things safe, and if there is like a coherent set of information that says radios make things more dangerous, like that's definitely a good reason to maybe take them out of the top level of the sport. But we have a bunch of world tour races where radios are allowed and a bunch of continental tour races where radio is not allowed. There is a difference in fields, but not really. I mean, they're both very, very high-end races. So it should be a simple, pretty much apples-to-apples comparison to see whether there is an uptick in dangerousness. And while I don't have these statistics in front of me, I think the fact that no article has come out with them suggests that there really isn't that sharp difference based on radios.
Indeed, whatever the cause that brought DJ down, he's now out of the race and he was unable to contest what ended up being just a fantastic stage 9 finish. A finish that for the final 15 minutes of that stage, there were just so many changes of the situation, so many changes of emotion for fans of different riders. If you were a Froome fan, there were probably a few minutes where you were pretty bummed out to see him kind of fading out and falling off the back. And then a couple of minutes later, he just came roaring back and he nearly took the stage win. Tom Dumoulin, similar situation, off the front, got brought back to heel by Froome and Rodriguez, and then just managed to come around and take the stage at the end. It was a thriller. There's no other way to describe
it. Yeah, I mean, if you were directing a movie about bike racing, you couldn't have done it any better than that. You know, bike racing movies are notorious for doing terrible things to people's impression of what constitutes a bike race. And to me, that was like Hollywood kind of suspenseful. It was a really interesting climb in that it wasn't completely a climb. There were several downhill sections. I think you had Dumoulin kind of riding to maybe take as much advantage as he could on the flatter sections. You had Froome doing the thing Froome does better than anyone else, which is just nail down that threshold, hold it there, and then make that one big acceleration. It just wasn't quite big enough. Like, I was pretty sure as long as Dumoulin could keep in touch with Froome and Rodriguez, that he'd be able to overpower them in the finish as long as it wasn't horrifically steep. But when they went by him and he didn't grab onto the wheel, I was like, oh, that's it, he's done. But it was just back and forth the whole time. Really, just this is, you know, the stage you should show people if you want them to be interested in bike racing.
One thing that I really liked about this stage was that it showed, I think, Chris Froome's wealth of understanding of the properties of physics. And it's something that he actually showed a fair bit last year in last year's Vuelta. There were a number of stages in last year's Vuelta where he did this, where the lead group would hit an extremely steep section and the top favorites would go at each other, just launching one little half attack after another. Nobody really committing, but just keeping a high pace for short spurts. And Chris Froome just sort of holding back and letting them go off the road and just saying, yeah, go ahead. You guys go ahead and do that. I'm going to just chill back here at my own pace. And then eventually he just works his way back up to the group only to leave almost everybody behind in the finish. I think he kind of realizes that there's very little aerodynamic benefit to be had drafting, or I guess in this case, not really drafting behind riders going, you know, 7-8 miles an hour up at 11% gradient. And so rather than going into the red every 5 seconds trying to chase down an attack, he just sort of works at his own pace. And over the long haul, it actually works out very much in his advantage because he's not burning matches. I mean, you saw Fabio Aru going on the attack a number of times and chasing down other attacks. He looked very strong on the stage, but I wonder if he wasn't far more exhausted by the time they got to the top of that climb because he had been so busy trying to chase down attacks, where Froome was just tapping out that steady washing machine cadence pace that he taps out and eventually working up to the summit at roughly the same time as everybody else, actually slightly ahead of them because he wasn't as gassed.
And to me, that's really kind of Chris Froome's greatest strength as a rider. I think especially because he tends to be so reliable on that first mountain stage in the tour that people get this idea that he's just a guy who storms away from everyone. And that's not at all how he rides. Like, yeah, when he's on a good day, he'll put it to people. But he is, you know, he's not a guy who waves a magic wand and is suddenly faster. He's a thoughtful rider. And I think he gets some flack for that because he is always looking at his stem, trying to see, you know, how hard am I working? How much room do I have to kind of go into the red, like what are my numbers right now? And you know, that's, I think it's something that a guy like Fabio Aru could definitely benefit from maybe taking a little more data into his tactical approach. I mean, everybody wants to see Pantani, but even despite incredible talent and some of the best chemical preparation money can buy, Pantani still didn't win that much. And I think at the end of the day, especially for GC and a Grand Tour, you're really racing not to lose, and you got to race smart. And I think there's some onus on people who talk about cycling to really highlight why racing smart, you know, what racing smart is and what it looks like. And while it may not, you know, be that crazy swashbuckling battle you saw in the EPO era, there's still a lot to appreciate about it. It can still be very exciting, as we saw at the end of this year's Tour de France.
Yeah, totally agree. So now we are heading into the first rest day with the GC picture that's still pretty much unsettled. I would say that it's still very hard to predict who's going to come away with the overall victor in this race. Tom Dumoulin has a GC lead right now of almost a minute, and then behind him, it's pretty much all knotted up between the big favorites. Joaquin Rodriguez, Chris Froome, Nairo Quintana, Fabio Aru, they're all still there. Esteban Chavez still in that conversation, although I think he might find himself in trouble in the high mountains here. It's just hard to say who's going to come out on top. I think we'll have a better idea after this coming week, which is just filled with high mountain stages. And I'm looking forward to a chance to see on Wednesday's stage who really is in good form. I don't think anybody's going to have a chance to hide on that stage.
They may want to hide, but they won't.
That's true.
There will be nowhere for them to curl up. And outside the GC, I mean, things look pretty up in the air. We've lost a bunch of sprinters, and even the sprinters we know and love, like John Degenkolb, not quite hitting on all cylinders yet. Some of that's tactical, maybe not related to their performance, but also it's been really cool to see these new names come up. I mean, Jasper Stuyven with his broken wrist stage victory. I don't know how many of you actually race, but when you're sprinting, you are really yanking on the bars with your arm, and it's just, you know, I've had, you know, kind of a smushed nerve in my hand, and it's been hard to really yank. So I can't imagine what that must have been like. Though I'm hoping the adrenaline gave him a little push.
And then Christian Spiragli coming out with that big win over Degenkolb. A lot of that was positioning, but it was still great to see, again, kind of a new name taking the victory. I'm thinking that that's probably not the last time we're seeing that happening at the Vuelta, just because the sprinting field has kind of thinned out a little bit, and all of the Vuelta stages are a little more interesting than your typical sprint stage. So I would not be surprised to see a few other new names coming to the fore. Caja Rural's Jose Gonsalves, for instance, has managed to find himself in the mix on both high mountain stages and in sprint stages. And I would not be surprised to see him take a win at some point. So all kinds of riders who we haven't seen a whole lot from yet, I think, could be in the mix coming away with stage wins in between now and the race finish in Madrid. So speaking of trying to come up with some names and predictions for stage victories, there are six stages in between now and the second rest day. So let's take a closer look at those stages and see if we can't come up with some potential stage winners. So the next six stages of the Vuelta are challenging, to say the least, especially the very first one on the plate. Stage 11, it's been described as the hardest ever stage in Vuelta history. I don't know enough about Vuelta history to say definitively whether this is the hardest stage they've ever done, but it's going to be a big challenge. It's not a very long stage, but it's just up and down all day long, and the climbs are hard. So it's actually, interestingly enough, it's a stage in Andorra, the micro state in the northeast of the Iberian Peninsula. It's only 138 kilometers, but it's a brutal one. There's three Cat 1 climbs in the first half of the stage. There's the special category, Collada de la Gallina, which is 11.7 kilometers at 8.5%. the Category 2 Alto de la Comella, which is 4 kilometers at a very, very steep 9.5%. And then the finishing climb, the Category 1 Alto Els Cortals del Camp, is 8.7 kilometers at a brutal 9.1%. The gradients are just extreme, and while none of the climbs are really, really that long, the fact that there's so many of them means that there's not really a whole lot of opportunity to catch your breath.
Yeah, it's up and down all day. I almost feel like this was sponsored by some sort of Spanish engineers road building guild to show what they could do with asphalt in situations where it would normally just fall off the side of the earth. But yeah, it's, I mean, I don't know, Dane, what do you think's going to happen here?
Yeah, I really have no idea. I'm sure that a breakaway is going to get up the road just because it's a pretty breakaway friendly stage, but then it's so hard, and I'm feeling that some of the GC teams are going to be so interested in putting the pressure on each other that I wouldn't be surprised to see an early move reeled in. But then in terms of who's actually going to come out on top, we just haven't seen enough so far in this race to get any real sense of who's the strongest right now. I mean, Fabio Aru looked really good on the first mountain stage, and Chris Froome looked not good. And then on the next mountain stage, Chris Froome looked amazing. So it's just hard to say.
And I mean, those mountain stages just don't compare to this mountain
stage. That's true. They're nothing like this. So I'm going to go with Fabio Aru as my stage pick for this one. He looked very strong on the first kind of mountain stage and pretty strong on the next one. I also think that some of the Spanish riders, the Joaquin Rodriguez and Alejandro Valverde club, are going to stare at each other on this climb. There's sort of a little bit of a rivalry between the two of them, and I wouldn't be surprised if Froome and Quintana spend their time doing the same thing, allowing Aru to get up the road a little bit. So who knows what's going to happen on this stage, but that's my best attempt.
I want to say Froome and Sky, but the climbs are just, they're just not the kind of climb that Sky has historically really been able to dominate. I'm going to go with Nairo Quintana here. He and Valverde haven't looked amazing, but they also haven't, you know, really been in their terrain, so to speak. Like, Valverde, definitely a man with ability on the shorter, steeper climbs we've seen so far, but these are huge, steep climbs. And they're both very close to each other on GC, so I think, you know, there's a lot of potential for teamwork, and Quintana is a guy who he never seems to show when he's going to be good. You know, it always just seems to happen. And I think if he gets 10 seconds, you know, on the last climb, he's just going to ride away. And I think with the GC cushion he has, people are maybe going to let him pull out some time. And given the current GC situation where a lot of people are pretty close together, you know, if he gains a minute on this stage, it's not the end of the world. Yeah, that's still a minute he's gained, but it's the hardest mountains are now behind the rest of the contenders.
In any case, I think we're going to get a pretty good idea of the GC situation after stage 11. Things could still change dramatically in between stage 11 and the finish, but at least we'll have some better idea of really what's what in this Vuelta. Stage 12 will be sort of a nice little respite after an incredibly difficult stage and before some tough stages ahead. A lot of the stage is downhill. There's a Category 2 climb in there that's pretty long, but not that challenging. I don't think it's going to drop that many people, and if it does, they'll have a chance to get back on. So I like this as a sprint stage. There's not a whole lot of teams left to control for a sprint, but I still like John Degenkolb's chances here to maybe finally come away with that stage when he's been hunting for 10 days so far.
I'm going to go with Movistar again. I'm going to go with JJ Rojas. He's looked pretty sharp today, again, with kind of benefiting from Degenkolb's lack of position, a little maybe miscommunication with the sprint train. But I don't think the communication with the giant sprint train is going to get any better with these days in the mountains, especially if they try and defend Dumoulin's lead on stage 11. There's going to be a lot of work that goes into that. And just not going to make him any faster.
I've just been happy to see that they've given him chances to go for sprint victories this Vuelta after the Volta a Catalunya, where he basically just let Alejandro Valverde win a couple of stages. And I kind of felt bad for him because he just doesn't get that many opportunities. And even when he's up there, the team says, can you just let Alejandro win today? Thanks.
Can you, if Alejandro is one of like three guys in front of you, can you just sit up?
Or tap the brakes even. So I would be very much hoping that he actually does come away with a win, because he's looked good. So stage 13, it's kind of a rolling stage. Not the sort of day I think that's going to have that much of a GC impact, but also not the kind of day that the sprinters are going to have much of a chance on. It's just going to be really hard to control. I think this is a perfect breakaway stage. It's always really, really hard to pick who's going to end up in the breakaways, but there have been several teams that have been particularly active so far. Europcar always active in the breakaway game, so I'll go with Cyril Gauthier here to finally come away with a win after many, many, many attempts in the last several big races to come away with a big breakaway victory. He looked pretty strong on the tour, and I think he's good again in this race and could come away with a breakaway win at some point.
I think I'm going to go with Caja Rural. I'll take Luis Masbonet, a strong contender in the KOM competition last year. Hasn't shown his head that much so far, but that could be good given the beatdown of this coming week. I kind of want to pick Martin Cialinghi again because he's been in a lot of breaks and I was kind of close. He was out there on stage 9. I picked him for stage 10. But, you know, it does take a toll. We'll probably see Cialinghi up the road a couple more times, but I don't think on this particular day he's going to be a super strong contender.
Stage 14, it gets really hard again. It's going to be another GC-oriented stage. I think there's a pretty simple, straightforward first half of the day, and then it gets pretty challenging. It's a Cat 3, a descent, a Cat 1, and then a flat run into a challenging special category climb.
Especial.
That's right. 18-kilometer, 5.5%. Not the hardest climb in the world, and the gradient isn't all that steep, but certainly enough that it's going to have GC implications.
It's a really long climb. It's like a Tour de France climb.
And that's kind of why I like Chris Froome on this stage. This is just his kind of climb. Long, not super steep, pretty steady. Wouldn't be surprised to see Sky tapping out a strong rhythm in the early part of this climb and then see Froome go on the move at the end.
Yeah, I'm definitely on the... I'm in complete agreement with you there. We haven't seen Sky do a lot as we're used to seeing Sky do, but that's mostly because other teams have been really willing to carry the burden. And if you look at the GC, they've got a bunch of strong guys. Roche is up there, Nieves up there. Froome gave a great interview after his narrow miss on stage 9, where he said, you know, it's the team has been keeping us super protected. And to me, that also means fresh. So even with the stages earlier in this week, I think we see what we're used to seeing from Team Sky. I mean, even Geraint Thomas has looked really good working from the break. So I think we see what we're used to seeing with Team Sky, which is a very organized, controlled lead out. Froome's going to take his shot. Usually, not always, but usually ends up taking the stage in those situations. So for me, the real question is going to be how the GC plays out.
Another thing to keep in mind is that the Vuelta is sort of leaving the arid and semi-arid southeastern corner of Spain behind and heading into what is often called green Spain, northern Spain, where the weather is significantly cooler and a lot wetter, actually.
And is this mainly where the rain falls?
This is indeed where the rain falls in Spain. And I think that's going to be helpful to some of the riders who have been suffering in the heat. So we could see some guys who weren't doing so great in the first couple of days actually do a little bit better in these mountain stages, where I think it's going to be a little cooler, possibly a little bit more wet, but it's not going to be as much of a brutal day under the sun. So for stage 15, we're staying in that part of Spain. It's another pretty simple, straightforward first half and then a challenging second half. It's a shorter stage than stage 14, but it does have a long, challenging finishing climb, 12.7 kilometers, 7.9%. That's pretty steep, and the finish in particular is pretty steep. I like Joaquim Rodriguez on this stage. This is the kind of climb that I think he enjoys. Not too long. It's not short, but it's not too long, and it's got a steep finish that will allow him to try an attack. He's been kind of conservative so far in this race, but I wouldn't be surprised if he finally went on the move here and actually tried to make something happen.
Yeah, I like that pick. I just don't want to be boring. So if you hadn't picked that, I totally would have, but I think I'm going to go with Valverde on this one. A similar kind of logic, like a guy who can ride long climbs, who can make that kick at the end. And I think, you know, we may be seeing a far more clear GC picture at this point in time, one which Valverde may not be part of anymore. So if he's given a free hand to play, I think this is a stage where he could do very, very well.
Stage 16, the last stage before the second rest day. Another very, very hard day. Just a lot of climbing. And in particular, the finale is a big challenge. There's a pair of climbs at the end. First one is 9.8 kilometers at almost 9%. The second one is 6.8 kilometers at a vicious 11.1%.
Especial.
Another especial category climb. And I don't think it's going to be a very comfortable ride to the top, especially after such a long day of up and down and up and down. It's going to be the kind of stage I think the breakaway will have a chance on, but I also think some of the GC-oriented teams will be trying to put the pressure on each other here, as there aren't that many really tough mountain stages left after stage 16 and a time trial on the horizon. So I like Nairo Quintana to come away with this one. I think he's sort of working his way up to form. He's been struggling in the heat. I don't think he's going to have to put up with as much of that in northern Spain as he has in southeastern Spain. So I like his chances here to maybe come away with a stage victory.
See, I see this stage and I imagine like half of the peloton quitting bike racing somewhere between the fourth and fifth climb. I want this to be a big GC day, and I just think everyone is going to be so beat after the previous five stages that there's just no, you know, the break could win this by, well, probably not 10 minutes. But I think this is going to be a breakaway day, someone where you see a kind of pocket climber. I'm not sure who, though. I'm running through the start list and there's no name just kind of screaming out at me.
I'm going to send you a Team Colombia dartboard because they tend to have those guys.
I like that. Team Colombia dartboard. I should have a random number generator just set up for this. I'm going to go with Carlos Julian Quintero. I think he's been active according to Dane earlier in the race. So, he'll be my dartboard pick for sure.
I like that. So that's the next six stages before the second rest day. A lot of climbs to be climbed in between now and then. Hopefully it's going to be an enjoyable next 6 days for us. Probably not going to be very fun for the riders, but hey, that's their job. We'll be back to do another show in a couple of days. But in between now and then, maybe we can adjust some of our GC predictions. I don't really know what to do in terms of my GC pick because I just have no clue what to make of the first 10 days. I had Froome, Quintana, and Aru on the podium, and I still see them all there. I don't know. I guess I'll keep my podium the way it is.
Yeah, I'm going to not have TJ there anymore for obvious reasons. I feel like I've seen this pattern before with Quintana, just kind of invisible for the first week, some sort of mystery ailment, if it's the heat or whatever. And then he really kind of surges. He has that one huge day and, you know, he either wins the race or comes in second. So I want, because I believe in narrative diversity, I want Nairo Quintana to be my new GC contender. I think Chris Froome is up there. I think Chris Froome is going to lose again. You know, not to say that he lost last year's Vuelta. He did not win, but he fought a really good battle. I think I see kind of something like that emerging. He definitely looked really good on stage 9, but you just can't compare stage 9 to the rest of this race. So yeah, I'll go with those as my top two. And third, I'm going to go with Joaquin Rodriguez. He is a guy very good at coming in third in the GC context. So he probably doesn't like to hear people say that, but he should take pride in it. It's very hard to come in third in a Grand Tour.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't be able to do it. Any kind of closing thoughts before we say adios before the next and final Vuelta show?
I'm wondering what's going to happen after this week. there's a time trial and there's a kind of mountainy stage and then there's a mountainy stage. And I am really hoping that things aren't incredibly boring for most of that. You know, I just, maybe it's because I kind of came into the sport during the Lance Tours, but I really have this memory of kind of blasé third weeks where it was table scrappers scrapping for table scraps. And I, as much as I appreciate that sort of tactical one day style of racing, it just adds a whole new dimension when you have the 3 week long competition kind of up in the air. I mean, even Froome won this year's Tour de France by a fair margin, but that last stage was still exciting because there was that chance, a very realistic chance, that he could lose time. He could maybe even lose the whole race. And I would like to have that excitement as much as possible. And I think everyone else in cycling would too.
I certainly would. And I like the way the Vuelta has taken risks by putting a lot of challenges in the first 2 weeks and not totally backloading everything. But I agree that there is that possibility that could get boring. So fingers crossed that it won't. There's a couple of riders who I'm eyeing as riders to watch, riders whose storylines I'm kind of following right now, who I'm thinking, even if this race is, from a GC perspective, relatively closed out by the end of the second week, I'll still be interested in watching their progress. So that's kind of what I'm going to rely on. I'm looking at, for instance, Alessandro De Marchi, who was a huge factor in the breakaway game in last year's Tour de France and last year's Vuelta, and signed with BMC sort of on the heels of his success, and has subsequently done pretty much nothing this season. He finally got into a breakaway in today's stage 10. He sort of tried to break away at the very end of the stage. I'm thinking he's maybe finally coming around to trying to get active, so I will be watching him and hoping that he can sort of live up to the breakaway specialist that we all thought he was going to be when he signed with BMC. And then I'm also curious to see how far Tom Dumoulin and Esteban Chavez can go. Both of these riders, just really exciting to watch, young and very talented, obviously, but really no frame of reference for how far they're going to be able to go in this race. Dumoulin in particular, sort of a time trial specialist, maybe a classics type guy who has climbed well in his career, but never anything like this. So it's been really impressive to watch him so far. And I'm going to enjoy hopefully seeing him try his best to hold on to that jersey.
Yeah, I thought Esteban Chavez did a great job kind of suffering through on stage 9. He made some attacks earlier in the, maybe not made, but matched some attacks earlier in the stage that he really didn't need to do. But once that lead group got away from him, he really just kind of, you know, he suffered. He rode his own pace, but he suffered. And he didn't lose that much time. He's still right in the GC mix. So if that was an off day, a pretty good off day to have.
Yeah, and everybody does have their off days. So I don't think it's necessarily over for Chavez just yet. We will find out, though, on Wednesday's stage 11. I think that's going to be a pretty good sign as to who's feeling strong and who's not. I hope you enjoy the next week of racing at the Vuelta. We will be back for our third and final show, which we'll do on the second rest day. Until then, you've been listening to the Recon Ride podcast. I'm Dane Cash.
And I'm Cosmo Catalano.
And that's our show.